All right. And we're back on In the Meantime. This is DJ Sweetie on enemycombatantradio.net. You can tune in live first and third Tuesdays of every month. And these programs are all also archived and available at enemycombatantradio.net/meantime. And I'm talking today with Joan Myers. We've been talking about some of the history of cooperatives, worker cooperatives, and also about issues of race and class and gender within cooperatives and how they tend to kind of reproduce social, norms or dysfunctions. And I think we were on a really good roll there for a while. Tell us about how you were saying that smaller cooperatives, especially less structured, less formally structured, maybe specialized, with less specialized roles, were kind of more prey to kind of some what we call informal hierarchies or whatever, or informal kind of oppression, essentially. Can you maybe compare that to how a larger cooperative might address that? Is it because they have more of a formalized system of grievances, etc., it's clear to people where their role is within the group, could it also be that it is more of a formally hierarchical organization because it's got so many different parts to it that it needs that? I'm wondering if you could go with that.
That's an interesting question. I think first off, while there is definitely, there is racism and sexism and all that stuff in the smaller co-ops, it's not like it goes away in the larger co-ops completely. And it's not like it goes away in the rest of the social world or other workplaces. And really, I think most of the co-ops fell apart not over explosions due to internal fights, of racism and sexism and all that within the co-op. The problems were more that they would lose a whole bunch of all the women, got, pissed off and left. Or they were unable to keep African-American Latino workers. Or, they're like, how come almost everyone here is from a middle-class educated background? That tended to be more of the problem. Mm-hmm. I think the larger co-ops, and that's really what I study. That's my area of knowledge much more than smaller co-ops. So I don't want to make a whole lot of claims for those here. But the larger co-ops are much more able to recruit and retain, attract and keep workers who come from, working class backgrounds, who don't have family money to rely on, because they're more economically stable and they pay better. So your job's going to be there tomorrow and next week and next year, so you don't have to get all worried about investing your time and your skills in it. And they pay well. They pay at least, and often better than industry averages. So, and I think that is absolutely key to having a workplace that is racially and class diverse, is having that economic stability and ability to pay. And that seems to come with growth. Mm-hmm. A lot of the co-ops resisted growth because, as you say, there's this idea that, when you get to a certain size, when you have a certain number of people, when you can't all be a circle of friends, have face-to-face control, then you get into hierarchy. Then you bring the man in. We don't want the man in. And, and some co-ops have really done an amazing job of resisting growing while also developing economic stability. And here in the Bay Area, the Arizmendi group is a great example of that, where you have the cheese board that says, we believe that we should stay a small size because that's the best way to have worker control and to have real democracy in the workplace. But we understand that, you don't want to be isolated. And you don't want this just to be a boutique, job for already elite cadre of workers. You want to extend this to other people. So they set up these Arizmendis, where first they trained one collective on their day off. And that collective went out and set up their own shop. And then that collective trained another co-op on their day off. And I think now there are 3 Arizmendis. There's planned to open a fourth. Hopefully you'll get those folks on there to talk about that model.
Hopefully.
That would be great. But another way to do it is actually, growth. Here in the Bay Area, you have 3 fairly large worker-owned cooperatives. Good Vibrations Which is East Bay and West Bay, and has, I think, about 200, I'm not entirely sure, between the mail order and the stores.
You mean employees?
Employees. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how many are members and okay. how many aren't. Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco, which is a little over 200. And I'm pretty sure almost all of them are members.
In one location?
In one location, in one store. And Alvarado Street Bakery, which is, I think, about 120. But you don't have to be a member with them. So it's somewhere around 75% are members. And they're mostly located in one place, although they have depots where they deliver bread. So there are a few workers in a couple other locations. You know, and they are all doing very well. And they're all doing very well by their members. And continue to be democratically controlled organizations.
How much of that is the kind of good or service they decide to provide? I mean, if they're... Is that a growing market that they happen to kind of choose, you know, or a kind of, you know, well, you know, higher income kind of a market, for instance, you know, specialty? I don't know much about the cheese board, but do they do specialty cheeses that aren't necessarily working class kind of staple or something like that?
The cheese board probably, you know, it's in the Berkeley gourmet ghetto. It's baked goods and cheese, and it's definitely your value-added kind of item. And all of these are, to a certain extent. You know, Good Vibrations is... adult products, sex toys, videos, you know, it caters probably across a spectrum. Its items are a little bit more expensive, but I think, you know, one of their selling points is that you get to talk to someone about it and they'll really describe it. They have very informed workers who, you know, who care about the product mm-hmm. and the company because it's their company and all of that. Alvarado Street Bakery, you know, they make health food bread. So it's not... You know, it's not Wonder, or it's, you know, it's not very cheap bread, but it's distributed pretty widely. You know, I mean, it's Safeway bread. It's not like you have to go to a, you know, the cheese board.
Is it Bay Area, or is Alvarado across the country? Or?
Alvarado, I'm pretty sure, is distributed all across the country. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, they're also doing very well mm-hmm. by their members. So there are a lot of different ways, and you know, so here you have a bakery. You have a natural food store, you have a sex store, you know, distribution, and there was Book People. Mm-hmm. They have since gone under. They're book distributors. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of different ways that this can be done and grow, I think. So I think to some extent, sure, it's about a niche, but it's not entirely. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of niche markets that seem to be a sure thing with smaller cooperatives that disappeared mm-hmm. and that weren't able to sustain themselves.
So growth is like the main model in terms of becoming a more viable for your members, kind of an organization.
That is an argument I am definitely trying to make. Mm-hmm. I think that growth has really been seen as a bad thing in terms of, you know, maintaining democratic control, and that's why I wanted to look at two big companies. Mm-hmm. When I started my project, I was looking at organizations where all the members did not meet together on any kind of regular basis. Now, one of them, People's Daily Bread, they actually do have mandatory membership meetings that happen quarterly, and everyone is in one room together. But, you know, 3 hours every 3 months is not really the same thing as sort of the daily operations. You know, so it is theoretically possible that everyone could still be in the same room. We're not talking about a 4,000 person company spread across three continents.
And could there be a collective like that, or a worker cooperative that could be like that?
Well, increasingly I think yes. When I'm looking at One World Natural Grocery, which is the one that has no management, as I say, what they have is a series of elected committees, very densely clustered democracy. So they have a lot of involvement at the department level, at kind of the work team level. They have committees sometimes within these departments. Well, they always have at least a committee that does hiring, but they have other committees sometimes if it's a larger department, say the cashier department, which has, I think, 40 or so members. They have some committees to do coordination of various other things because it is harder for them to have 40 people. So you have, they all meet together, you have committees within it. Then you have committees that coordinate between it for buyers, for instance, the people who decide what products are going to be on the shelves, who you know, what distributors they're going to use, and they meet. You have other layers of levels. You have the, what's it called? The inter-co-op coordinating committee, which kind of does the day-to-day management sort of stuff, like how much space do we have, who wants this end cap, you know, who's gonna be doing the cleaning in this area, which department's in charge of that, kind of coordinating between all the committees, and they also handle grievances.
So this is almost like a management.
It's almost like a, yeah, it is. They do some managerial function, but they don't have, they can't really tell the departments how to do it. They can make recommendations. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when they have, I was there when they tried to institute a policy for a department, and the response was, you know, the hell with you, we're not going to do that. You know, that just is not going to happen. You pass this policy, good for you. We're not going to do that. And they really had to back down and bring members of the department in and talk and negotiate and come up with the structure, because the departments are very empowered. Mm-hmm. They're very empowered. They also have a board of directors that makes more of the financial and long-term planning. But what's different between a traditional management company and these is that these are, you know, for one thing, these are workers who still have most of their work time is spent doing their other jobs. It's not like they're full-time managers, mm-hmm. in any sense.
Okay.
They're paid the same for doing these managerial functions as for, you know, stocking bread on the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
And they're temporary. You know, workers are elected to these committees, and they may choose not to run, they may not be reelected, and they're very vigorously contested, most of these elections. Mm-hmm. People really care about who gets put on and, you know, who mm-hmm. runs. It's not sort of a formal democracy, but not really democratic. There's very vigorous debate about what's going on in most cases.
So you think this could, you see that there's even more room for expansion?
Yes. I think that because they have all, you know, and they didn't start out that way. They started out with maybe a board of directors and departments,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, one or two other little committees, and they developed all these things to kind of manage their growth from 15 people to 200 and some people.
Using some sort of model that they had seen elsewhere, or just kind of organically developed it on their own?
I don't think anything comes from nowhere,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of it, they pretty much self-invented.
Mm-hmm.
They had ideas. Some of them were involved with political groups. Some of them were involved with other businesses that had different practices, like, hey, let's try this. But there was a lot of trial and error and things that, you know, worked. Mostly they aim at, you know, what's often called transparency. But I think opacity is actually a better term, because they try to make things visible. Things that seem, you know, invisible, and you can't understand how people are doing it and what are the connections, they try to make these things very visible, you know, real. This is how this works. This is how this is structured. And some of that is through creating new bodies, new organizational bodies that do things. And some of it's just through, like, okay, people don't understand the finances. They think there's a secret cabal that owns One World. We're going to have a night of fine dining and finances, and, you know, sat down and kind of explained what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that is possible. And with a lot of the technology, it's increasingly possible. At my other site, which does have management, but they also, you know, they're... I don't think the CEO could do something that was complete, you know, he could be fired by the board of directors, the board of directors could be, you know, recalled and replaced with a board of directors from the membership, which could immediately fire the CEO if they wanted to.
So the membership does have control of the board of directors.
Do on the books.
Okay.
I think the CEO has done an amazing job managing people. An amazing job. People see their paycheck as a result of his prudent
mm-hmm.
and shrewd management, and I think they would be terrified to fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a good thing.
But
they have depots, right? So they
yeah.
have these far-off locations, and they are considering, how do we manage our growth? One of the ways might be to build another plant,
mm-hmm.
you know, another bakery somewhere that would be part of this thing that wouldn't simply spiral out the way the Arizmendis do,
okay.
but would be part of the same thing, and they're thinking about technologies that would allow them to do that. And I think it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's possible. I don't know if it's practical or desirable, but it's possible.
Did you see the movie The Take by Naomi Klein? It just came out as a documentary about Argentina, and the thing is, it's about worker movement, and basically they're taking over factories or reclaiming them in their mind. And there's an interesting comment in there that somebody made, that when they first took over the factory there, the team is interviewing them and saying, you know, what's going to be like, what are you going to do, why is this going to be different, etc. And one of the things that one of the guys said, and the other guy next to him was kind of like, yeah, he kind of agreed. He said, we're all going to get paid the same. And I wondered, you know, is that, how common is that today in groups that have been around for some, you know, 30 years or whatever, you know, is that considered appropriate to have different pay scales depending on how long you've been there or the kind of specialization of the job, or is there kind of a tending to be kind of a democratic on or equal on the pay scale?
I think that there's a sense of needing to find some sort of equality through the money somehow, and they do, different cooperatives do this in different ways. Burley Design Collective up in Oregon that makes those great bike trailers that you always see, and they also make some bikes. Everyone gets paid the same. They have managers, but everyone gets paid the same. You know, if you've been there 20 years, if you've been there 6 months, everyone gets paid the same. And it's a huge point of pride among the workers there. You know, it's not, they're all in it together in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And complaining, and they lose general managers constantly because the general manager's like, I should not be getting paid the same. I do so much more than anyone else. At Rainbow Grocery, they all start at the same wage, so they, I know, were really proud that they hired a lawyer. Actually, they hired two lawyers at different times. One of them's Tim Hewitt, who works with Arizmendi, and hopefully you'll talk to him. Mm-hmm. At Alvarado Street Bakery, they share out their profits among people who aren't even members. You know, they hire people based on the pay for hiring is based on kind of industry averages. Mm-hmm. So you get paid, you know, how much is production work, how much is office work, how much is management work, depending on what's going on in the area. Mm-hmm. And they're all, you know, in different ways, they all do address this question of, you know, how do we interrupt the natural logic of capitalism, which says that, you know, some people deserve more money than others, or that profit, you know, should be divided by how much training you have. Yeah, by the owners, you know, like who have done what, you know, who have done what, who provided the machinery.
Risk their capitalism.
Yes.
I mean, well, then I guess that's one of the big questions. Then I mean, I hear people say this, talking about cooperatives or even kind of. Well, yeah, worker-owned kind of cooperatives, that what is the difference ultimately between a well-democratized internal workspace and a, you know, very hierarchical or even despotic kind of corporation if they're producing the same kind of goods or widgets? If Safeway can stock, you know, a bread that's by a cooperative just as easily as it can stock something by a despotic corporation, what is the larger, the kind of spillover effect of a cooperative, you know, versus, what is its impact? Is it shaping the other corporations, the other entities that they work with, or where, on what level are they going beyond kind of an internal democracy? Not to say that it's irrelevant or that's not enough, but I'm just wondering how do they fit within that larger system? Is there a sense that there is some potential for them to alter a system, make it even more?
Yeah. You may need to remind me of this question again, because I would like to make a comparison to the union movement.
Sure.
And I might get lost. But, this, you know, this was always an issue with unionization. Should unions be primarily trying to spread, you know, get the best rights, get the best conditions for all workers? Mm-hmm. Or should they be focused on trying to get the best contract, you know, the most safety, the most stability for those workers who have joined the union and have organized? And obviously it can't really be an either or, because you can't have a good contract for a small group of workers if the rest of the industry is unorganized, because then, you know, the owners of that factory will just shut it down and open up somewhere else. At the same time, you can't organize a lot of workers if you haven't proved to them that you're able to do something. You know, as the union, you actually make changes for them. So there's definitely a give and take. And I think it's very similar. It's a similar issue that worker cooperatives face. I don't think you can provide economic democracy in just one corporation, you know, just one company. You can't have socialism in just one country. Mm-hmm. You can't just have, you know, work to spread it everywhere. So,
or capitalism, for that matter.
Or capitalism. Absolutely. So I think that the different worker cooperatives have different takes on this, and some see themselves as, you know, providing a model, you know, and by talking about themselves as worker cooperatives and playing themselves up as worker cooperatives, they demonstrate to, you know, if you go to Safeway and you buy a bag of People's Daily Bread Bakery that says a worker cooperative on it, you know, it keeps alive this idea of, you know, a worker cooperative. If you go to their website, it, you know, explains what a worker cooperative is. How many people go to a website? I don't know. Other worker cooperatives, for instance, Burley Bicycle refused to have their work done in China. You know, their main competition right now is Chinese-produced bicycles. But they make all their bicycles in Oregon where they work, and they really play up how they're providing jobs for local people, you know, kind of that, making that connection between worker-owned cooperation, worker-owned ownership, and keeping jobs in local areas and not letting kind of capitalism run away from its problems, run away to other countries and develop the problems abroad. But, you know, and I, with the cases that I'm studying, I've seen, you know, it's very interesting. When the United Food and Commercial Workers were striking in Southern California, you know, that's a strike in Northern California, there was a lot of question of what their, you know, these their workers were going to do in response to it. And, you know, it wasn't affecting either of them directly, but, you know, what about delivery of bread? You know, were they going to go into these? And when I was asking some of the workers about that, you know, how are they going to deal with this strike issue, they sort of saw me as asking how they were going to deal with this obstacle. Well, you know, often we'll have a deal where we can deliver around the back. You know, they didn't see it as a question of solidarity, which kind of surprised me because they have a very strong discourse about class and class solidarity there, but there didn't seem to be much solidarity. Whereas at, and you know, and there was no, it was a consumer boycott, right? Mm-hmm. That was all that the strikers were ever asking for. It's not like they were going to be mm-hmm. breaking any picket line. But the grocery workers at the other cooperatives that I study, who weren't going to be affected because they weren't unionized, they had started a voluntary strike fund and were sending money down to Southern California, you know, towards from their own wages because they felt like they had common cause as grocery workers, even though they weren't outside. So I think that there are ways in which the politicization can happen through participation. And really, I mean, I think that one of the great things about People's Daily Bread Bakery is that they've been able to make it very easy for anyone to join a worker cooperative. You know, it's not like it's this special thing and you have to be a specific kind of person and you have to look a certain way and, you know, don't shave your legs or whatever. And that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And they have, there almost no one who works there now, except for maybe their drivers, had experience in any kind of collective or cooperative beforehand. They came from other production jobs, other shipping jobs, other office jobs.
Were they attracted to that, or are they?
They're attracted to the pay.
They're attracted to the pay.
Most of them didn't even know it was a cooperative. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd say a lot of people didn't know it was a cooperative at One World Natural Grocery either when they applied. But they liked the groovy atmosphere. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a big part. They felt comfortable mm-hmm. in that kind of milieu. But there is much more politicization that happened in their first year. I heard workers who, you know, said to me, you know, when I came here, I thought, man, this place is wide open. You know, I can scam completely on this. But within a year, they said that they felt like, oh, my God, I'd be stealing for myself. You know, why would I do that? Mm-hmm. Or who began to get much more active in running it. They just thought, oh, I'm just going to come here because it pays really well. You know, again, that's a huge draw. And I think it's an important draw. It pays really well, and it's pretty good on the body. It's not like, you know, this other job where I'm constantly being asked to do unsafe things and, I don't want to call my union rep all the time, and mm-hmm. whatever. But increasingly, they found a political voice and became much more active and involved. And I think that that level of getting active and involved in on the department level, maybe on committee levels, leads to a sense of oneself as a political being who might have connections to unionized Safeway workers in Southern California. Because it's hard to account for why there would be such a difference otherwise.
Right.
Because, you know, I would not say that most of the people who came in to either organization first had a real strong sense of, like, solidarity with other working folks.
Right. Tell me, what do you know about what people are doing with kind of like the not just like what, beyond the wages, but the kind of the extra capital or the profit they've made? How are they dividing that up? Are they, is it a priority to then own the place in terms of like the real estate actually that it sits on? Mm-hmm. Is that a priority for people? Is that like a dream that, okay, you know, once we get big enough, we can actually own this and stop paying rent, etc. Or are there other things like political funds that people are prioritizing for their profit?
Well, I know a couple. It's about 50-50 in terms of owning the physical site, I'd say, of the larger co-ops. Some of them see more advantage in leasing, long-term leasing. In my study, One World wound up buying their building because the market changed rapidly, and they were locked into a really great deal where they, you know, bought it at this ridiculously low rate. So, you know, even if they went under 5 years later, it was going to make sense to buy it and have this as a, you know, as a property mm-hmm. later. I know Burley up in Oregon built the most beautiful factory you've ever seen. You know, it's like every worker has a window, pretty much. Although they're at this point draped with all sorts of fabric and propped on all sorts of things. You know, and sometimes they complain and say, oh, you know, we really overbuilt. We spent way too much on this and that. You know, we're getting hammered by overseas production and there's a problem. We shouldn't have put that much money into, you know, a building. But I think they also love it and it is gorgeous. It is gorgeous and safe and clean. But they see themselves, I think, much more politically than many of the other co-ops. The other co-ops, my study, again, it really is fascinating. Both co-ops see themselves as having survived as long as they have because they've stayed out of politics, right? They're not political. They're not, you know, they're business-oriented. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why they succeeded where all the other ones failed. And they're pretty much in the same region, these two co-ops.
Not identified to a certain movement or something like that.
Right, yeah. Right. And in the Bay Area, also, there, a lot of the co-ops here also have that feeling of like, oh, you know, good thing we got out because there was this huge gun battle in the 70s.
Yeah.
A little bit of this history. It's, you know, that would be
another
great.
Show.
Yes,
another show.
Exactly.
By the way, we have like 1 minute or 2 minutes. Sorry.
but even though these two groups see themselves as non-political, right, in my study, they have such different reactions, you know, as the Southern California strike shows, whereas one is like, oh, you know, that is not our concern. The other, you know, sets up this voluntary strike fund. So I think what it means to be political is not very clear, you know, to work. It's like, well, maybe that means stopping the war. But, you know, but within short of that, there are all sorts of things that I think they do, especially increasing knowledge about worker cooperatives and, you know, alternatives to traditional capitalist workplaces.
What would you recommend, maybe as a wrap-up, for if people want to get more information, you know, what their websites or organizations in the Bay Area particularly?
Well, there's NoBoss, Network of Bay Area Worker Collectives, and they have involvement from the largest to the smallest. And there are some great websites that I haven't written down, so I don't know any of the URLs for. But there was recently a National Federation of Worker Cooperatives that was set up, and they have a website. And if I can find the link and send it to you, can you put it on the webpage?
I can put it on the enemycombatantradio.net/meantime.
Great.
Okay, I think we're done with our show here. It might not be recording anymore, but I want to thank you very much, Joan Myers, PhD candidate who is studying two large worker cooperatives. What else can we say?
Thank you, DJ Sweetie.
Okay. Thanks a lot. And here we go with some more music.